Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jason Rose. I'm here today on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Timothy Petty. We're asking at this time that this court reverse the district court's decision to grant summary judgment and that this court return the case back to the lower court for trial. One unusual aspect of this case is that the district court initially denied summary judgment. In its initial opinion, the district court recognized that Jones v. City of Chicago provides the proper framework for analyzing instances of serious police misconduct. This court held in Jones that police officers violate the Constitution when they conceal material evidence from prosecutors and misrepresent those actions. This court also observed in Jones that Jones probably would never have been charged in the first place if prosecutors had ever been informed about the police misconduct which occurred in that case. 25 years after Jones, this case yet is another unfortunate instance of this court having to consider the misconduct of members of the Chicago Police Department. Initially, the district court in this case recognized that defendants' coercion of witnesses and their undisclosed methods of inducing witnesses to make identifications is exculpatory evidence and that such evidence must be disclosed under Brady v. Maryland. As the district court initially observed, when the police use coercive techniques to create lineups, when they use sleep-deprived and drug- or alcohol-affected witnesses to do their bidding, then the ensuing identifications being relied upon by prosecutors are subject to challenge. The district court initially ruled that Petty could show that he was prejudiced for purposes of Brady, even though he was ultimately acquitted, since a jury could find that prejudice ensued as soon as Petty was charged with murder. The district court also recognized, at least initially, that there was sufficient evidence to support a constitutional cause of action under this court's precedent, most notably in Parrish v. City of Chicago. In that case, this court held that a plaintiff can still have a Brady claim even if he is acquitted, if prompt disclosure of the suppressed evidence would have altered the prosecutor's decision to proceed to trial. So what are the facts that led the district court in this case to first denying summary judgment, and why did the lower court then reverse itself? Well, the facts, in our opinion, when looked at most favorably to the plaintiff, are quite damning to the defendants.
Well, Petty, by his own admission, stated that he knew before his trial that the police had allegedly tried to coerce a witness into identifying Petty as a shooter, right?
Well, what happened is Frederick Tarver filed a lawsuit approximately, it was over a year after Petty was indicted. And yes, so, but there...
And there was a hearing in the criminal case, wasn't there, prior to trial, seeking to suppress Tarver's testimony? Wasn't that the purpose of the hearing?
There were two hearings. The first one, I don't think, was Tarver did not testify at the first hearing. He did testify at the second hearing. But what does Brady require? Brady requires disclosure by the state. We have no disclosure by the state whatsoever. We have Frederick Tarver suing the city of Chicago, saying that these things were done to him. And, in fact, the city settled that case and paid Fred Tarver for being held for 17 hours against his will.
Right, but the cases also say that if the undisclosed information comes to the suspect's attention before trial and sufficient time to use the information, the exculpatory information at trial, there is no suppression within the meaning of the Brady right. So that's what happened here. Your client had all this information and, in fact, made use of it. So there cannot have been a suppression for Brady purposes.
Well, what was the evidence that was given to Petty?
Yeah, but we're saying that's irrelevant in this instance because he got the information.
Well,
he got it, and he got it in time, and it was detailed because the lawsuit had been filed. He got lucky in that sense because a lot of times that may not happen. But the point is, he got the information in time. He was able to use the information. So we can go with you on the fact that the city should have disclosed. Okay, so then we have to go. That's not where we stop. You get that, right?
I get that. But what is the evidence that Petty was entitled to? What they're saying is that Frederick Tarver claims that this was done to him. But the fact of the matter is, the police said no. Frederick Tarver is wrong. Frederick Tarver's lying when he says this was done to him. And in fact, the prosecutor in this case has admitted that if she had any idea or reason to believe that this identification was the subject of coercion, she wouldn't have prosecuted.
Well, in looking at the ASA's testimony about that, it seems a lot more equivocal to me than that sort of firm, I would never have authorized the charge. I don't read that out of what she's saying.
First of all, Your Honor, I think the evidence is undisputed that there's no physical evidence in this case.
She says, and there's no other evidence, I don't know, but hypothetically, I probably would not approve charges. That's not a very firm statement.
And
in fact, what happens is the prosecution is clearly aware of all this because of going through the two hearings you referred to, and yet persisted with the charge through trial. So how would that have affected Mr. Petty's facing the charge?
Obviously, for summary judgment purposes, when she says, I probably wouldn't have prosecuted, I believe that's more than sufficient, and certainly there would have been no reason for her to prosecute in the absence of a good identification because, as I indicated before, there was no physical evidence or any other evidence whatsoever in this case. But what is Mr. Petty entitled to? We maintain that it's not enough, in our opinion, to say that Frederick Tarver filed a lawsuit and that's it. Because the fact of the matter is the prosecutor chose not to believe their recantation, which is the prosecutor's right, and the judge decided not to believe the recantation. Well, that's all well and good, but for purposes of this lawsuit, this court must accept that the misconduct that's being charged in this case actually occurred, that Frederick Tarver was held against his will for 17 hours, that he was put up to identify Petty, and that he was threatened by the police and whatnot, and that's all laid out. So we believe that what we're entitled to is the process. What's happened is, with the police not coming forward and saying, yes, this is what happened, the statement of Mr. Tarver
ask it this way. If Petty had gotten that information from the police or the prosecutor, how would the course of the prosecution been any different?
If we had been given that information
did pursue the prosecution through trial.
What Petty was entitled to was a statement by the police or by the prosecutors that Tarver was coerced.
So was there any, because he had...
Not that Tarver claimed to be coerced,
right,
that Tarver was coerced.
Oh, so they'd have to admit that there was coercion.
Correct.
But
which is for purposes of this case, which is what this court must accept actually happened.
So the defense here would have to agree that this evidence was manufactured, that this was not coerced truthful testimony, but manufactured evidence.
And there is evidence in this case that this identification was manufactured.
Well, let me ask you this. Didn't he have the right at the trial to subpoena the officers?
Absolutely.
Were involved in his case?
Absolutely.
That investigated his case, he knew their names, and he had subpoena power. So he could have brought them in. If you wanted to get the actual truth from the lips of those who engaged in this conduct, right?
Well, when you say the truth...
Well, not the... Well, whatever they say. But the point is...
You'll get what they say.
Exactly. But
that's not true.
I'm saying is you had subpoena power. You could have brought them in. They may have, in your view, lied under oath, but Petty had the opportunity because he knew... So he knew about the allegations, and he also knew the police officers who had investigated his case. True? He's had the police reports?
He had the police reports.
Right. Their names were on the reports, like
right.
A standard police report. So he had the ability to subpoena them and bring them in. you know, we can debate whether or not they would, in your view, lie or be truthful, but he had the power to do that. He had sufficient details.
That's true, Your Honor. But what you're
suggesting... I'm understanding Brady as a disclosure requirement that the government has to turn over information that could be helpful to the defense, but I don't understand it to be that the government has to agree that it helps the defense. In other words, it can be impeaching information, but it doesn't necessarily negate the underlying facts.
First of all, as I said before, and I'll try not to repeat myself, there was no disclosure whatsoever by the state. Okay, but putting that to the side, we believe that what we have here is a due process violation, and that due process violation exists above and beyond Brady. Okay, this is not simply a Brady violation. And if the city's position is sanctioned by this court, what we will have is a situation where police officers can coerce witnesses, deceive prosecutors, continue to lie about what happened, and deny their coercion throughout the criminal proceedings. And
So doesn't that run into our Newsom case? Doesn't that theory, isn't that blocked by the Newsom line of
cases?
Well,
I think the issue here is that Newsom runs into Whitlock, which was handed down by the court the same week, by this court, the same week that the district court reversed itself.
But Whitlock didn't grapple with Newsom or McCann or the Supreme Court's decision in Albright.
Well, but Whitlock did some important things here, and I believe that it affirmed Jones and extended Jones. In Whitlock, this court observed that there's no longer any dispute in this court, if there ever was one, that fabricating, withholding, and suppressing material exculpatory evidence is unconstitutional.
Right. I understand what the case said, but it didn't take into account this conflicting case law in our circuit and in the Supreme Court that says that kind of claim is not actionable. That's basically a malicious prosecution claim, and it doesn't lie in 1983.
If this court wishes to reverse Whitlock, then...
I think we need to explain it and understand it in the context of what came before it, which is Newsom, McCann, and Albright, and the undeniable fact that Whitlock didn't address that line of precedent, either overlooked it or it wasn't cited to the court, but we have to understand it and reconcile it with the directly conflicting case law. I mean, if it had intended to overrule Newsom and McCann and interpret the Supreme Court's decision in Albright differently than Newsom and McCann had, then it would have had to circulate under Rule 40E and actually do all that kind of legal heavy lifting, which it did not do.
I agree, Your Honor, there's two lines of cases, one which has Jones and Whitlock, and then another case that has Newsom and some other cases. I believe opposing counsel is asking this court to reverse Whitlock, but the result of reversing Whitlock is going to be twofold. First of all, as cited in our brief, the first, the second, the fifth, and the eighth, ninth, five other circuits have held that a due process consultation lies under these facts. On top of it, there's another district court, the Sixth Circuit, which just recently issued an opinion in Mott v. Meyer that held a Fourth Amendment malicious prosecution claim under these facts. Now, I understand that that's not the road that this court has gone down, but the fact is that there are now six federal circuit courts that would hold that a constitutional claim lies under these facts. And does this circuit court wish to be the one court that says the police can do whatever? Because I think if you think about it long and hard, what you're suggesting is the police can
Newsom
do whatever they want.
I don't think Albright, which is the Supreme Court case, or Newsom or McCann stand for the proposition that the police can do whatever. What they say is that when the police fabricate evidence, that's actionable under state law. That's a malicious prosecution claim, and those remedies are adequate. And so it's not a freestanding due process claim actionable under 1983. That's what those cases stand for. It's not a blank check to the police to fabricate evidence without a remedy. It's an acknowledgement that there is a remedy, and it's in state law.
It's saying there's no constitutional violation.
Right.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Beyer?
May it please the court. I'd like to start my comments by focusing on the district court's specific ruling in this case. In the course of reaching summary judgment in favor of the defendants, the district court recognized that Mr. Petty had violated Local Rule 56.1 by filing a statement of additional facts that was far in excess of the 40-paragraph limit set forth by Local Rule 56.1. Mr. Petty does not dispute that he violated Local Rule 56.1 by filing 169 paragraphs of additional facts. And this court has recognized time and again that the district court is well within its discretion to hold parties to strict compliance, not substantial, not partial compliance, but strict compliance with Local Rule 56.1.
And your bottom line is essentially that what was left then, that the court properly considered, did not allege enough facts to support his claim.
That is correct. The 40 paragraphs that remained of Mr. Petty's statement of additional facts got no further than some of the police officers had requested that witnesses come to the station, and that's as far as he got in those 40 statements. And nothing in the defendant's statement of facts in any way concedes that there was provides any support for his constitutional claims. It sets forth that Mr. Petty was arrested, that he brought forth Mr. Tarver's testimony in support of a motion to suppress prior to his criminal trial, and that the state court found no misconduct by the police. And Mr. Petty does not raise any argument, any discernible argument in his briefs, that remaining material was sufficient to defeat summary judgment. Turning to the, and we believe this case can end right there with the Rule 56.1 issue.
We don't even have to get to the constitutional violation in terms of the witnesses being held against their will for long periods of time.
That is correct. It simply isn't in the record. That part of the facts has been stricken and was not taken into account. And if those facts were taken into account, it would effectively undermine Local Rule 56.1. And the point is that parties need to comply with it to make the district court's docket easier to control. And submitting
does the rule indicate that if you submit more than 40, only the first 40 are considered? Why is it the first 40? I'm not understanding that.
I'm not sure if the rule itself, but Judge Kendall's case management procedures, I believe, make it clear that additional facts will not be considered. That if you submit over 40, and it seems a natural assumption that if you submit the first 40, that those would be the ones that survive. I'm not entirely sure if it's clear in all cases, but it seems clear here that the first 40 and the defendants
in
their
motions. Is that what the district court said, that she would only consider the first 40? And, in fact, is that what she did?
That is what she did.
My reading of the decisions is that the court essentially gave these claims plenary review. But she considered all the cases and all the different theories that were being advanced for constitutional violations here, including the Whitlock claim on motion for reconsideration.
It appeared I'll try to separate out the three steps, the initial ruling, the second ruling, and then the ruling granting summary judgment to the defendants, and then the denial of the motion for reconsideration. In the ruling on summary judgment, initially denying summary judgment, district court relied on what appears to have been a misunderstanding of the Parrish decision, interpreting Parrish to transform Brady from a disclosure rule to a discovery rule, requiring that information be disclosed prior to trial. And that's not what Parrish said, on top of the fact that Parrish, when it made that discussion, was speaking in dicta. Parrish was actually a Newsom case.
Right, and then the court went back over that and reconsidered that. And came out differently, and then the court denied the plaintiff's motion for reconsideration based on Whitlock. But as I read these decisions, these are basically legal issues that the court has decided. These are not heavily fact-bound decisions saying the factual record, because it only contains the first 40 statements or paragraphs of disputed fact, is insufficient to make out a claim. And these are decisions based on the state of the law about whether conduct like this, in other words, fabricating evidence and not disclosing it, is actionable under Brady here, where the criminal defendant had the information in advance of trial, or as a freestanding due process claim.
In the initial, just to make sure I have not misspoken, in the initial ruling on summary judgment, there were facts. The court, district court, believed that the facts were sufficient because the defendant's statement of facts noted the disclosure during trial. So I agree that on the facts, the district court at the time believed that that was enough. But
and
that
did,
was the
The district judge deal with the ASA's testimony about whether a charge would have been brought in the initial summary judgment ruling?
I believe it noted that testimony, but when it granted summary judgment, the district court further noted that the prosecutor was aware of Mr. Tarver's allegations and proceeded with the prosecution nonetheless.
And were those facts in the first 40 of the plaintiff's statement of facts?
The ones that
you just talked about.
Proceeding with the trial nonetheless?
Right.
Those were in the defendant's statement of facts.
Which were admitted.
The decision that the court made did or didn't have anything to do with the motion to strike?
I believe it did. When the court was recounting the facts in its initial ruling, it relied solely on the facts that were admitted and that were within the first 40. It went no further than that. Later there was a footnote. I do not recall precisely if it was in the motion for ruling the motion for consideration or the order granting summary judgment, but noted that would not have mattered to the court if the additional facts had been taken into account.
What I'm trying to get to is whether this motion to strike has anything to do with the merits of the decision that's before us right now, and it sounds like the answer to that is no, that we need to address whether there's a Brady claim here and whether there's a freestanding due process claim. This motion to strike is just kind of a red herring.
We would disagree with that characterization. We believe that the motion to strike was not a red herring, that was a substantial portion.
It doesn't decide the case.
We believe it does, but we believe that it's irrelevant ultimately to the ultimate disposition of this appeal. We believe this court can affirm whether or not those facts were stricken. Because first, as Judge Chinder noted, this information was disclosed. Mr. Tarver's information, I'm referring specifically to the Brady claim, this information was disclosed. And
well, it was learned of. It wasn't disclosed by prosecution or the police.
I'll be more precise. It was not suppressed. The definition of suppression encompasses both direct disclosure by the state, by the police, and information learned from other sources. And that second part was clearly the case here. It was learned from Mr. Tarver. Mr. Petty seems to have conceived of Brady as not what it is. Brady is a component of the right to a fair trial. It's not a right to his version of the truth, to his version of the truth being accepted. As this court has said, it's a right to have the evidence allowing the jury to determine where the truth lies, to determine for itself. And that's exactly what he had here. He had a fair trial. He had the information before him that he says was suppressed. He had a chance to prevail both in a motion to suppress and at trial, and he ultimately prevailed at trial. So we believe that the Brady claim falls short because of the disclosure by Mr.
Can you talk about the interplay between Whitlock and Newsom? In other words, and specifically discuss whether the language of Whitlock really contradicts Newsom, or does it just expand upon Newsom to cover new police conduct?
Well, we would believe that Whitlock, to start, I hope this is responsive, we believe Whitlock does not in any way undermine Newsom, and our position is that it could not have undermined Newsom because Newsom merely implements Albright, Supreme Court what this court has consistently recognized is the controlling holding of the Justice Kennedy's concurrence is the controlling holding of Albright, that as long as malicious prosecution exists, that there can't be a freestanding, as this court called in McCann, a hybrid Fourth Amendment malicious prosecution claim clothed in the guise of a due process claim.
Has the Supreme Court returned to that subject since the Albright decision?
Not to our knowledge. In my research, I've found only a passing reference in a footnote that implies that it's, and just to say that it was an issue that was not raised by the parties, and we cited that decision in our brief, just said that the issue had not been raised by the parties, whether a claim would have been foreclosed under Albright. Other than that, I'm unaware of anything. In Parrish, this court noted that on at least that occasion and one other, that attempts had been made to say that the Supreme Court had implicitly overruled Justice Kennedy's reasoning in Albright, and this court rejected that. That was the main gist of Parrish. Most of the portion about Brady was just dicta correcting a misapprehension by counsel, misunderstanding of Brady by counsel regarding the effect of an acquittal. But there's been nothing, and this court's gone so far as in Avila to say that this is so, the Newsom-Albright principle is so settled that federal jurisdiction does not attach, that it renders these sorts of claims frivolous from the outset, so frivolous that they can't even invoke the authority of the court to hear them in the first instance. And I believe in Avila, this court, sua sponte, addressed a jurisdictional issue, as was its right, and vacated the district court's decision. As for Whitlock, Whitlock was decided on expedited briefing. It was an expedited briefing schedule. And the parties, according to, I believe it was the Kane decision from the district court, the parties never addressed Newsom, never addressed Albright. And that's also true of the cases cited in Whitlock. Whitlock cited cases out of circuit that contain language saying, we consider this self-evident. We can't find any cases supporting this, but we just assume it's self-evident.
So how do we deal with with Whitlock and Newsom? How can we reconcile those two cases?
We believe that here it's unnecessary to reach what Whitlock does because there's no dispute that Newsom, Petty has never disputed to our knowledge that Newsom and Albright forecloses claims. So we believe it can be saved for another day what Whitlock specifically does. Whitlock did not purport to change the state of the law set forth in Newsom that's been consistently recognized in cases citing Newsom ever since.
I thought the plaintiff's motion for reconsideration was all about Whitlock.
It was about Whitlock, yes. That is correct. But they've never gone so far to say that it has actually overruled it. The closest they've got is that it implicitly overruled it. And that's just simply not how overruling takes place. The cases we cite are clear that there needs to be an acknowledgement of the decision to be undone and then circulation so the court can be aware and have a full discussion, that it's so the full court en banc can vote and determine whether a case needs to be overruled and can take it up for full en banc argument if it is necessary. That did not happen here, and it appears to largely have been the result of the parties in Whitlock, likely because of the expedited briefing schedule, but it's unclear. After reviewing the brief, they're very long briefs, so it's unclear. There were a lot of issues raised in Whitlock.
Well, let me just ask you this question. This police officer is holding witnesses to a crime against their will. Your position is that that can never be a constitutional violation?
Not so long as Justice Kennedy recognized. As long as the state recognizes that there is a claim for malicious prosecution, then the freestanding due process claim, these hybrid due process claims, which Mr. Petty essentially admits in his reply that is what he's trying to bring here. He, when asked what the basis for his larger policy argument was, he admits that it was a Fourth Amendment claim that he meant to bring, and that's precisely what Newsom and McCann recognized were problematic, these hybrid claims trying to drag back in a supposed Fourth Amendment violation beyond the statute of limitations and call it a due process claim, and this freestanding, undefined due process claim that's caused so much trouble in trying to define it. There's no guidepost. There's nothing to define it. And that claim would, in fact, to the extent that Mr. Petty has argued in his reply that his Monell claim was based on the Fourth Amendment, that claim would have been barred by the statute of limitations. The statute of limitations was 2 years, and we know on page 27, note 7 of our brief, that that claim had long been barred by the time he filed his complaint in this matter. If there are no further
questions. What was it in the Whitlock case that caused the briefing to be expedited?
It was not an. I am not.
Well, I thought it was the appeal of a grant of summary judgment.
Whitlock, as I understand it, was an appeal, a qualified immunity appeal. So that may have been. I'm not entirely familiar with exactly why it was expedited. My recollection is that it was, in fact, expedited briefing. I'm not sure how expedited.
I'm sorry, denial of summary judgment. Right.
Yes, and there was a qualified immunity, and there were jurisdictional issues permeated the opinion, and it just appears to have been briefed very quickly. And unfortunately, it appears the Newsom issue was just not raised by the parties.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. We request that you affirm.
All right. How much time? No time? I'll give you 1 minute, counsel.
Your Honor, I won't discuss Rule 56 unless the court has any questions. But just last year in Whitlock, this court held that all courts that have directly confronted the question agree that the deliberate manufacture of false evidence contravenes the due process clause. This case falls squarely under Whitlock, and that's what this court held last year. Furthermore, as cited in our brief, there's at least 5 other circuits that have held that a due process violation exists under these facts. So if you have trouble understanding how this fits under Brady, then I suggest you throw Brady to the side and say it's not Brady, it's a due process violation, and the violation occurred when Teddy was charged with crimes that he didn't commit, and when he lost his liberty for 2.5 years because he was faced with false charges. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.